I am on a medication that speeds me up. I'm on prednisone, and I don't know, anybody here ever been on prednisone? On it. You're taking prednisone, it's like zoom, 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 zoom. So somebody like me, I'm like zoomy, zoom, zoom, zoomy, zoom. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can be totally refreshed after about 4 hours of sleep. Right? Eat like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah, it's a crazy drug. It's good though. Okay. Why are we here? What's going down? Why are we way down here? That's weird. What happened there? Da-da-da-da. Okay, the hip joint. So, as we know, the hip joint is made by the head of the femur, of course, which is this almost complete ball, and then this concavity, this acetabulum here, and they fit together to form the hip joint. We do know it's a ball and socket joint, of course, then. And as compared to the shoulder joint, it's built for range of motion but stability, because it carries so much weight of the human body that we want a lot more stability here for us to get around. So it's ball and socket, therefore it's multiaxial, and it's formed by the femur and the acetabulum of the coxal bone. So we can see here how they kind of come together. So the femur, of course, we know that the head of the femur is completely covered with hyaline, except at the fovea. If you remember the fovea, the indentation at the head, which you find a blood vessel and a ligament. Ligamentum teres is in here. And that there is no hyaline cartilage in this small area. And it sits within the joint, but outside the joint to some degree. We'll find out in a moment. The acetabulum holds more than half of the head, and there is a very deep acetabular labrum. So we did have a labrum in the glenoid fossa that somewhat deepened the relationship between the scapula and the proximal humerus. But again, stability versus mobility, it wasn't that deep. Whereas in the hip joint, the labrum really, really deepens the concavity of the acetabulum, which makes it much more stable. Now, there are two regions within this acetabulum. The first is called the lunate surface, and this is the articular surface, and it's horseshoe shaped. So we can see here that when we're looking at the hip joint, the whole acetabulum is not hyaline cartilage. There's this lunate surface, or this lunate part, this horseshoe shaped part, that is the hyaline cartilage that articulates with the head of the femur. Okay, so it doesn't go, you notice it doesn't go all the way around, and in the center, there's something else going on that is non-articular. Everybody got me? Right here. So this is the real one. And you can see that here is the ligament of the head of the femur here, holding the femur in. Okay, and there's the head. And you can see the articular cartilage here. And then you can see that there's no articular cartilage here. This is the synovial membrane that's covering the material that's within here. But we can see that there's also a ligament down here holding the two ends of the articular cartilage kind of together, but apart, right? So from here all the way around to here, and then this border right here, that is hyaline cartilage, and that is what articulates with the head of the femur in any movement that's given. Does that make more sense in that picture? Okay. So the whole acetabulum isn't just hyaline cartilage. It's just this ring around the labrum and on the outer margins of the superior part of the acetabulum that we find the articular cartilage that articulates with the femur. And we can see it sort of here, it comes out to the margin of the labrum here, and it sort of ends though kind of here on this side. You can see it. So it doesn't fulfill the entire acetabular fossa at all. Okay? All right. So that is the lunate surface, thought to look a little bit moon-like in the Krieger crescent moon. The next is in the part that is non-articular, and that is known as the acetabular fossa. It's in the central acetabulum, so it's that center within that, inside that crescent moon, if you want to call it that. And within it is a fat pad. And what the fat pad does is help that ligament in the head of the femur kind of sweep and get out of the way so it doesn't get stuck within, right? So the fat pad kind of supports the head of the femur, the ligament. But because the fat pad is within the articular environment, on its surface, it does have synovial membrane, okay, sitting on top of it. So, of course, synovial membrane, as we know, it provides those synovial sites that produce the synovial fluid and so forth that help with it as far as that goes. And then we have that the lower part of the acetabular fossa is closed by something called the transverse acetabular ligament. So, how many transverse ligaments have we got now? Three that I can think of. Transverse ligament between C1 and C2, transverse humeral ligament at the bicipital groove, and now we have the transverse acetabular ligament at the bottom of the acetabulum. So here we've got here in the drawing, here's the articular surface here, the lunate surface here. That's the articular part, hyaline cartilage. And then we have the acetabular fossa here that has a fat pad that supports the ligamentum teres, or the ligament to the head of the femur. And then we can see here at the bottom that there's this ligament that travels across the bottom here, the transverse acetabular ligament, that fulfills the entire circle. It's got synovial membrane on it as well. It's just not articular either, right? But it just provides some synovial membrane here. And then there is the ligament for the head of the femur does kind of tuck underneath, comes from underneath this transverse acetabular ligament here to go into the head of the femur. Little side story, when I was cutting meat for a living, anybody here know what a hind of beef looks like? Ever seen a big hind of beef? We put it on a hook, right? Right, you see that, right? So think of your leg and your buttocks hung upside down. Okay, so we cut the foot off, and then the cow leg is on a big hook between the Achilles tendon and the muscles of the shin. So that is where the animal hooks onto and hangs. So we would have to cut off what's called the sirloin tip, which is the quadriceps group, and then we would cut off the loin, which would be, your erectors and part of the abs, that kind of stuff. And then we would have to bone out what's called the hip, and that would be the gluteal region, right? So we're cutting away all the gluteals. Take them off the bone, so you'd have the, you guys think of them as round roasts, eye of the round, that kind of stuff, right? So you take it all down, and then you would completely take the meat off so that the pelvis, the only thing that was holding that entire mass, was the ligament of the head of the femur. So the meat would literally hang upside down with the bone still on the hook, and I would dare any of you guys to get up there and jump as hard as you could on top of that piece of meat, and it would not break. That ligament was so powerful that held the head of the femur in that acetabulum. And we literally had to take a knife and kind of wind your way around and cut that ligament to the head of the femur in order to take that piece of beef off and put it on the block and cut it into roasts or steaks or whatever, maybe as far as that goes. So it was very powerful. So, as I said, we've got two parts, the lunate surface, which is really the articular surface, and then the acetabular fossa in the center, which is the non-articular. We've got the fat pad, we've got the ligament to the femoral head, we've got the transverse acetabular ligament here, kind of fulfilling the full circle, somewhat supporting the tips of the lunate surfaces or the hyaline cartilage, and somewhat provides some fiber, doesn't provide actually, attaches to some fibers of the ligament head of the femur. So the acetabular labrum, as I said, like any other labrum, is fibrocartilaginous. And it deepens the concavity of the acetabulum itself, so it makes it quite deep. It is attached to the bony rim of the acetabulum. So if you look at, the model here, it just kind of makes sense. We see a circular acetabulum here, and then we've got they've kind of put the labrum on here, but they're, right around that margin, we would see the labrum right around the edge of that circle of that acetabulum. It, of course, clasps the head of the femur, and it then furthermore adds more stability to the articulation. So it kind of, with the femoral head in, it kind of just isn't huge. It's not a big thing like that. It just heightens it and brings it in just enough that head's in. In fact, when you, as I said, I think I said to you guys last week, go find a hip replacement surgery, and you'll see that they have to pop the ball out of the hip joint in order to do the artificial hip. And it does make, you can see it pop. It actually has this popping motion that it comes out of the joint. It's quite a strong joint. But once they know what they're doing, it doesn't take much at all. They just external rotation, tink, out it comes. So you can see it's been removed here, and you can see just the depth that the labrum places here. It really, really does deepen the joint. Of course, there's your lunate articulating surface there. There's your fossa covered in synovial fluid. Here's your transverse ligament that we can see here. And then there's the head of the ligament, the ligament to the head of the femur that we can see right here. Ultimately, what they need to do this anytime they do a hip replacement, they do have to remove the head of the femur out of the acetabulum. And some hip replacements, I said last week, it's just the head. And some hip replacements, it's the head and an acetabulum. So they actually cut out the existing acetabulum and put in a prosthetic acetabulum as well. It really depends on the extent of damage to the hip joint. Of course, it's synovial, so therefore we have a fibrous capsule. It is a cylindrical sleeve that encloses the hip joint and most of the neck of the femur. So it does come down, obviously enclosing the joint, but then it comes all the way down around, it comes down onto the neck. So it encloses the entire articulation between the two from that acetabulum down onto the neck of the femur. So again, providing stability to some degree, because the fibrous capsule isn't that strong, but it comes around and tightens in around like a purse string around the neck of the femur. The fibers run parallel to the neck. So it attaches from the rim of the acetabulum and labrum to the intertrochanteric line anteriorly. Do you remember where that was? Right? Your intertrochanteric line ran kind of here, correct? So it really does cover an extensive amount of this joint, therefore providing, all the things that it does. Approximately 1 centimeter proximal to the intertrochanteric crest posteriorly. Therefore, we say that most of the neck of the femur is said to be intracapsular because it's within the capsule. So the capsule covers so much area that it's said to be intracapsular, the neck. There are two identified areas to the fibrous capsule. The first is called zona orbicularis. These are the deep fibers, and they run circularly around the neck. So tightening in that fibrous capsule around the neck, okay? And they do assist to hold the femoral head and the acetabulum. The second are called the retinacula, and rather than being circular, they're longitudinal. So they're deep longitudinal fibers. They're reflected superiorly along the neck of the femur. And what we have here are the blood vessels that supply the head and the neck of the femur. So we can see here we've got this round one, right? We can sort of see the capsule here. You can see how much it covers all the way around. You can see we have this circular zona orbicularis here that sort of, as I said, is acting almost like a purse string that kind of tightens in the capsule. And then we have these straight along fibers here running parallel basically to the neck, and those are your retinacula area. Again, they are providing some support and holding things kind of tightly in, okay? Of course, there's a synovial membrane. It lines the fibrous capsule, duh. Lines the labrum, lines that fat pad. It also surrounds and covers the ligament to the head of the femur. So the ligament to the head of the femur is within the articular environment, but it's not in the joint. Does that make sense? Right, so it's surrounded by synovial membrane, but it's not covered in synovium. Kind of makes sense? Yes, no? Yep. So if we look at, oh, that one can go in the garbage. And we've got the kind of the ligament here. I'm going to cut it away. What we're saying is that the ligament is within the articular environment, but the synovial membrane covers the outside of the ligament. So you've got synovial fluid heading this way, but the ligament, because it's within the synovial membrane, is not in the synovium. that make sense? Now? No? Yeah, I know. Yeah, do circles, do circle. yeah, because it's within, you're going to learn the same thing in the knee. So you have two major ligaments in the knee called the cruciates. They're in the knee, right? They're very deep in the knee, but they're surrounded by synovium. They're not within the fluid or the synovial fluid of the knee. The head of the ligament, the ligament of the head of the femur is within the joint environment, but it's not bathed in synovial fluid because it's surrounded by synovial membrane. So outside the membrane, it's wet and juicy and jointy, but where the ligament is dry. Does that make more sense now when I say it that way? Okay, so it's in there, but it's not in there. Does that make sense? Yes. Okay. No, you're not. You never are. I can see all the faces. There's some drooling going on, right? Kinda, yeah. So I'm using that analogy because it's not in the synovial bathtub, right? It would be like putting your hand with a glove in to a bath water. Your hand inside it's in the tub, but it's not in the tub. Does that make more sense now? Okay. Yeah. Like I put a big glove on, the tub's full of water, I put my hand in. Is my hand in the water in the tub? And no. Because it's in the, right, it's not wet in the water because it's covered in a glove, correct? It's in the water, but my hand is not wet, correct? It's the same as this. It's surrounded by. Yeah. Right. Because it's completely glued on the outside of it is synovial membrane, but it's inside the knee. This is the same. We'll talk about it again when we get to the knee. Quite often, the synovial membrane communicates anteriorly with the iliopectineal bursa. Of course, not unlike the shoulder, the knee, the hip has a lot of bursa in it. And remember, whenever a bursa is an extension of the synovial membrane, we say it is a intrinsic or communicating bursa. So sometimes the synovial membrane pops out through little holes and provides bursa for structures in there. It does protrude inferiorly to the fibrous capsule posteriorly, and this forms the bursa that protects the tendon of obturator externus. Okay? We'll get to those bursae in a moment. But you can see here is the iliopectineal bursa here that's popped out between the extrinsic ligaments here, which we haven't really gotten into yet. But this is an extension of the synovial membrane from within the joint that's popped out between the ligaments, thus forming a bursa that we can see here. So you can see here is the transverse ligament of the acetabulum, and here is the ligament head of the femur. So it's within the joint, but because it's surrounded by synovial membrane, it's not considered to be articular. Probably the better way to put it. You can see here we've got the labrum coming out either side here, and then we've got the cartilage. Of course, the head is completely covered in hyaline, but only the lunate surface is hyaline in the hip joint. And then, of course, we have the joint space and synovial fluid and synovial membrane and so on and so forth because it's a synovial joint, right? Here we've got, you can get a look and see how a lot of these bursa are. So here's the obturator bursa here. But this is the synovial protrusion on the inferior aspect sneaking out from underneath the fibrous capsule. We have this synovial membrane that comes out, and it does provide a small bursa here at the bottom as well. Okay, now what's interesting, again, you're going to have patients who've had knee replacements, guarantee it, at some point in your career, right? So when they do a knee replacement, there has to be consideration. They don't cut through all these ligaments. In your hip, they don't cut them through. They don't. They make a surgical approach in such a way that they pop the head out between the ligaments. they don't want to do any disruption to these massive holding elements of the hip joint, because when the patient comes out, even though it's prosthetic, they still have to have it appropriately supported and so forth. Back in the old days, if you want to use that term, the approach to do a hip replacement was lateral. So they came in quite large, superior to the greater trochanter, in all the way down to inferior, and then they would pop the hip out accordingly. How many people here have, when you're boning out like a chicken breast or a chicken leg, you've popped the hip joint out of the backbone when you're removing a leg out of the chicken? Anybody here done that? Yeah, see how easy it is? You haven't cut any ligaments, but you've popped out between them and it comes out quite nicely, right? I'm not talking about when it's cooked, I'm talking about when it's fresh. We're no different than the chicken. It's all about the position of the patient. So external rotation and abduction, and they just do a little more twist and it just pops right out, slides in between those ligaments and exposes itself where they're able to remove it. So the approach now that's used for hip joint. So in the old ways, when it was the old days was lateral, you were in bed for about 5 days with a walker, kind of moving to go to the bathroom and so on and so forth, and a lot of physio. We used to have what are called sliding tables. And this is something to kind of put in your back pocket. They were weak enough that we didn't want them working against gravity because it may do damage to the surgical site. So we had these slide tables, almost like a floor on a table that was really slippery, and they would do abduction with a sock on so they could slide back and forth. They were using muscles to strengthen to some degree, but not against gravity because they were obviously running, transversely through the plane. So they would go that way. Now the new approach is, and if anybody in your family is getting it done, always ask them, is it the anterior approach? Because the anterior approach, they're walking with about 3 to 4 hours after surgery without a walker. Right? So it's the new way. And my understanding is a lot of it's done arthroscopically until they have to actually cut the head of the femur off, that kind of stuff. A lot less disruption to the holding elements. It seems to be that they can get at the femoral head much better anteriorly without a lot of disruption. Because even though they're not cutting the ligaments when they're dislocating the joint, because that's basically what they're doing to do the prosthetic, you're still causing strain and sprain, right? You're taking ligaments and muscle tendons and so forth and putting them in a position they're certainly not supposed to be in. So you do get some disruption. It just seems the anterior approach, however they're doing it, is a lot less disruption. The joint is very, very stable after that procedure. And as I said, the patient is able to get up and walk within hours after that procedure compared to days. So it's really made a difference. So yeah, so if you've got anybody, ask them, make sure you get let's say, I've heard you should get the anterior replacement. Make sure you get that done. Most of the surgeons have gone to that now. I would think most of them have so. But there's still old ones out there, so. Okay, ligaments. So obviously, we have had modifications of a deepened acetabulum, a very large labrum, a complete ball of the femur, almost two-thirds surrounded, a joint capsule that does also further support through a longitudinal fibers and circular fibers and so forth. But we still have to have big, powerful ligaments that need to hold this and still continue to provide stability. So the first ligament is called the iliofemoral ligament or the Bigelow ligament or the Y ligament, okay? It resembles an inverted Y, and you'll see that in a moment, and it is considered to be one of the strongest ligaments in the entire body, okay? Very, very strong. This is found on the anterior aspect of the hip joint. It attaches to the AIIS, the ilium proximal to the rim of the acetabulum, and it goes to the intertrochanteric line, the greater trochanter, and the medial to the lesser trochanter. So it takes a very large surface area when we look at it at the hip joint. So we can see it here. You see the Y shape here? Y. Okay, hence the reason why it's got such a large attachment area here. It's like this inverted Y. We can kind of see it here as well. And you can see it has a bit of a twist to it and so forth. And it's a very strong, powerful ligament. So This ligament checks internal rotation and extension. So when you get into that joint feel, which you've been talking about, going into internal rotation and extension, you're going to put tension on here, and this is where you might feel a ligament ascend feel. Okay, when you, under normal circumstances, if the patient has got like a pathology of some kind in the hip. It allows you to stand with the joint in extension using a minimum of muscle action. So with that just normal standing, which of course we'll find the femur extended, right? It's extended. So when I'm standing like this, the majority of my weight and stability comes from this ligament, not from muscles holding me in. A whole entire different idea as compared to the shoulder, right? The shoulder is all about, the position of the shoulder is related to the strength of the muscles across the joint, correct? There are some holding element ligaments, but nowhere near we require our muscles. The hip joint has a lot of stability in ligaments that hold it the way it needs to be. Okay, in full extension of the joint, the capsule and this ligament are taut. Therefore, it helps to maintain erect posture. This is what allows us to stand up appropriately in erect posture. Okay? As I said, you can see it both here and here. The next, and of course its name tells you, right? The iliofemoral. Makes sense, from the ilium too. The next is the ischiofemoral. This reinforces the capsule posteriorly. Okay, so where the iliofemoral was anterior, that inverted Y, this ligament is posterior. It arises from the ischium portion of the acetabular rim. Okay? Spirals superolaterally to the neck of the femur. So we see that this, here's a bit of our iliofemoral that's going to head anteriorly, but here's our ischiofemoral, and you can see it does this little kind of funky twist when it comes into its attachment. So again, here we are. In this drawing, we can see how it comes over around and twists to come into its attachment. So it twists the femoral head medially into the acetabulum during extension of the hip, therefore it resists hyperextension. So when you go into extension, it internally rotates the head deeper into the acetabulum. Okay? Thus helping with excessive hyperextension. Any questions? You can see there's another bursa popped up there as well. Okay? Pubofemoral. This reinforces the capsule inferiorly and anteriorly. So now we have anterior support, posterior support, inferior support now, and further anterior support. Pubofemoral resists hyperabduction. I couldn't imagine hyperabduction, eh? Ow. Although there's probably some gymnasts in here who could do the splits where they're right down flat on the inside of the thighs or right down on the mat. I couldn't imagine even attempting that. I'd never get back up again. And internal rotation. So what we can see here is the pubofemoral ligament here. So here's your iliofemoral, you can see here. And you can see your pubofemoral here comes off the ramus of the pubis here and comes down onto the femur. So reinforces the capsule inferiorly and anteriorly. The other ligament is ligament at the head of the femur. We've talked quite a bit about it. Also known as the round ligament, also known as ligamentum capitis femoris, also known as ligamentum teres. Yay. Three names. I'm somewhat prone to ligamentum teres quite often. That's something I might use. Its attachments, the acetabular notch and transverse acetabular ligament to the fovea of the head of the femur. It is inside the fibrous capsule, surrounded by the synovial membrane. Therefore, we say it's intercapsule. Right? That's what I just went through with you guys in the hand in the bathwater and yada, yada, yada. Okay? Its function. First, it helps carry the artery to the head of the femur. So we can say that part of its function is vascularization because it contains the artery to the head of the femur. It also assists in lubrication. So between it and the fat pad, it does help spread synovial fluid throughout the joint in the relationship between the two, thus maintaining a nice slippery environment for things to move around in. And then the last is, which is at least important, it does pull tight on adduction. Okay. So we can see it's been cut here, and work rises out of here, same as you can see it here as well, with the femurs, again, being cut and removed. And there's your transverse ligament there. You can see it does share some fibers with it. As I said, it's a very strong, powerful ligament that holds it in. This transverse ligament, we said, runs from the tip of one part of the lunate surface to the other to some degree. It crosses the acetabular notch, and it fills in the gap within the labrum. But it converts the notch into a foramen. So if I take this, can you see how there's a bit of a concavity here? If I put my finger across the top, you'll do it this way. Can you kind of see the foramen underneath? Right? So there's a bit of a foramen that gets produced as this ligament runs over top that's below it. You kind of see it there? Okay. Now, this foramen allows the acetabular artery, because it comes from obviously another area, it comes underneath this foramen into the ligament at the head of the femur, and then follows the ligament at the head of the femur, penetrating into the fovea, which then has a blood supply, direct blood supply, to the head of the femur itself, supplying the spongy bone that would exist deep within the head itself. Okay. You can kind of see it coming underneath here. It does also provide branches into other structures within the hip joint itself. Bursae, lots. We can see quite a few of them here. We've got a lot of stuff that crosses over top, but we have a very large trochanter here. The one thing, when we're looking very proximally at the hip joint, we have a lot of muscles that arise from the proximal aspects of the ilium, and have to cross over onto the greater lesser trochanter, intertrochanteric line, so on and so forth. So you can see with the musculature here in place, you can see all these bursae, because we have a lot of soft tissue that crosses bony tissue in the hip joint, so therefore we need a lot of bursa. So the potential for a hip bursitis is somewhat there, right? So iliopectineal. This bursa runs underneath iliopsoas. It often communicates with the joint anteriorly through space between the pubofemoral and the iliofemoral ligament. So when I say it communicates, that's telling you that the synovial membrane is popped out between those two ligaments, thus creating a bursa in that area by the sheer fact that it's synovial membrane. And it can be considered an anterior hip pain. So it may be a factor in anterior pain characteristic in hip joint disease. So hip joint disease, quite often we're talking about arthritic changes in the hip joint between the acetabulum and the head of the femur. Okay? So we can see it right there. Trochanteric. So this reduces friction between the greater trochanter and the gluteus maximus. So this is where the gluteus maximus comes over top. It is more extensive posterior laterally, which kind of makes sense, right? Because the glutes coming from the back to come onto the trochanter. And there can be one or more of them. So we can see here we've got this trochanteric bursa here. Now this sucker, anybody here heard the term with football players called hip pointer? I don't even know if it's used much anymore. Is it kind of used? Yeah. So what it is, you can imagine this is a site of impact in football, right? You're taking a helmet or a shoulder pad or something into this area. And also the cuts that football players do to force that stability and doing it all the time. Basically, hip pointer is nothing more than trochanteric bursitis. And it has to be treated accordingly, which quite often is anti-inflammatories, ultrasound, those sorts of things. If it's bad enough, they can't get rid of it, because it will swell up. Occasionally they will go in, they'll remove some of the fluid, leave the needle in the bursa, and then take an anti-inflammatory and directly inject it into the bursa itself in hopes to lower the inflammation in the bursa to get it sort of back to normal. Okay? But it can be broken up into various parts within this area to kind of help cover everything that crosses. So those are the only ones you really need to know. There are more, but those are the ones you need to know. Movement and stability of the hip joint. Of course, this is a ball and socket joint, so flexion extension, AB AD, and flexion extension, AB AD, and come on, people. You got it. External and internal rotation. Correct. Okay. And you can say circumduction because all those movements result in circumduction, right? Stability. It's a stable joint because of this deep socket and the head of the femur is close to a full sphere. These massively strong ligaments and a very strong labrum. Now, what's interesting here is there's a vacuum in this joint. So when it's made inside MUM, it actually creates a vacuum. So we say coaptation, the closeness between the two structures, the head of the femur and the acetabulum, coaptation is maintained by atmospheric pressures creating a vacuum effect at the joint surfaces. My understanding is, because I've never been live at one, but when they pull that that head of the femur out of the acetabulum, it goes, you can actually hear the pop because the pressures are changing. Okay? And of course, this is important to understand. This is maintained with all soft tissues removed and hanging freely. So even if I were to strip off all the soft tissue and muscle around the hip, this vacuum between the two structures will still be maintained and will keep some stability to this joint. All right, you guys are quiet today. Oh, don't want to do those ones yet. We'll do, where are we here? Hip joint, pelvic floor. There we go. Like I knew I had it. All right, muscles. Here we go. Same as usual. How do you guys find going through every single muscle? Do you find it boring? Okay. Let's do the flexors first. Remember all the movements that occur here. The first major muscle for hip flexor is the psoas major. Notice I haven't said iliopsoas. We'll find out there's a reason for that. This is psoas major. It arises anteriorly on the bodies of T12 to L5. Think of where that is. Oh, I was teasing the semester ones about because they haven't palpated it yet. And I'm like, yeah, you get down to about here in the abdominal wall to get out, and they're all eyes are all like this big, right? So yeah, you wave your hand, get the intestines out of the way, and then you go. So anterior bodies, quite high, T12 to L5. In other words, basically, all the lumbar spine, right? So anterior surfaces, lumbar vertebra, and T12, sometimes not, sometimes yes. And anteriorly on the TVPs of L1 to L5, and it goes to the lesser trochanter. So when we look at, here we see anteriorly, okay? We have to think about this. Here's our greater trochanter, but you can't see the lesser trochanter, can you? So if you think about it, if the spine's back here, right, where the anterior bodies are, this muscle somehow has to get to the lesser trochanter, which is here. Now it's a hip flexor, okay? So it can't come this way, can it? So it's got to come this way, correct? Right, so that means we're going to discover that it goes over top and down to the lesser trochanter. So anteriorly on the bodies of T12 to L5 and the intervertebral disc between and anteriorly on the TCPs of L1 to L5 to the lesser trochanter of the femur. So because it crosses the hip joint anteriorly, you get flexion of the thigh at the hip joint, which is its prime movement. So what I want you to see here is that this muscle runs anterior to the pelvic bone, but posterior to the inguinal ligament. See that? So when you feel that inguinal ligament, right, remember running from the pelvic bone down to the pubic crest, okay, that iliopsoas, psoas for now we're talking about, crosses anterior to the bone of the pelvis, but posterior to the inguinal ligament. Okay, so it's coming from back from the anterior bodies of the spine and traveling over and in front of the pelvic bone. And then it's got to come back down around to the lesser trochanter. You following it in your mind now? You've got a kind of a mind map going on there, okay? See, we always see pictures like this. You don't get the sense of where it's going here. So anterior to the pelvis, posterior to the inguinal ligaments, okay? So it crosses the hip anteriorly, which is flexion of the hip joint, which is its major function, is a hip flexor. If the pelvis is fixed to the thigh in flexion, this muscle pulls the thigh pelvis as a unit to posteriorly tilt the pelvis at the lumbosacral joint. Okay, so we will pull the pelvis up, correct? Okay, which is kind of what can happen when it gets tight. It crosses the hip joint anteriorly in such a way that it wraps around to attach to the lesser trochanter posteriorly, which pulls the lesser trochanter anterolaterally, resulting in lateral rotation. But it's a very weak lateral rotator. I wouldn't even ask you a question on it, but there it does provide some support there. This muscle also crosses the spinal joints laterally so that when the spinal attachment is fixed, it pulls upwards on the femoral attachment, and if the femur is fixed to the pelvis, the pelvis will be elevated at the lumbosacral joint. She'll get some elevation there with it. Its reverse action, because it crosses the spinal joints anteriorly, when the femoral attachment is fixed, this muscle flexes the trunk, right? So when the trunk is fixed, it does this. When this is fixed, it does this. Okay? Remember me talking about semester one about those silly things you see in the gym where you step in and you put your forearms and your hands on there and you're doing these swings with your legs and you think you're doing your abs? Okay? Well, now you understand why you're doing your hip flexors. Okay? This muscle also crosses the spinal joints laterally, and when unilaterally contracted, you can get lateral flexion at the trunk as well. Innervation, lumbar plexus, L1, L2, and L3. The muscle test, of course, would be, you'll see it as resisted hip flexion, right? So you can see the diagram here. Stretching it, there's a couple of different ways. This is marvelous. This is one of my favorites. Because quite often when people do this, now, if someone has really tight hip flexors, like really tight hip flexors, this is good enough for them. But quite often you'll put the patient in this position and they'll say they don't feel a stretch. As soon as you ask them to do that, they feel it. Because it's two actions, are hip flexion and spinal flexion, going into hip extension and spine extension will do a beautiful stretch on this muscle. I would even venture to say that there is no reason to ever strengthen this muscle. This muscle gets used all the time, and most of the time its problem is it's too tight and too strong. You can do a stretch this way as well. So you're into this position, right? And then what you're doing is you're stretching across the other side. And you can feel it. But again, I've seen this until I was dating a yoga instructor, and she made me come to her classes, and I got into this position. I'm like, oh, this is a really good psoas stretch. I like this. What's this called? Warrior One or something? Crescent lunge? Okay. There you go. Oh, I didn't pay attention. I was looking at her. Strengthening it, you can see here, right? And surgical tubing, again, if it's quite weak. But most of the time, as I said, this muscle does not need to be strengthened. It's usually a problem because it is too strong. Trigger points. Trabell refers to a psoas muscle as the hidden prankster. Because it serves many important functions, it can cause pain while also being relatively deep and inaccessible. It can also cause changes in posture, which affects back and neck muscles, leading to trigger points. Again, that sway back, right? If it's going to pull down, then you get that anterior tilt of the pelvis, and then the back will compensate by going into extensive lordosis to maintain posture. Three main trigger points within it. and they referred pain to the low back, sacrum, and to the upper part of the thigh or groin area. Palpation in the abdominal trigger point area generally refers pain to the back, along the spine, to the SI joint, sacrum, and upper gluteal region. Palpation of lower can really refer pain to the back and also to the upper thigh and the groin area. So sometimes expressed as possibly pain in the genital area, in that sort of that deep groin area, as far as a referral pattern goes. You guys do this often? Do you go in and treat psoas on each other very often? Or you did the palpation last semester and you haven't done it since? You just did palpation on Wednesday? Oh, and how was that? Did you all find it? Did you have them resist? Well, wait, how did you do it? You put their foot on, you put their legs on a plinth? Sorry? Yeah, just bent knees supine? Yeah, with pillows underneath the plinth. Right. Yeah, I like doing it a different way. It's the same idea, but I actually take the two legs in my one arm, and I actually, as I go in, I bring them into more flexion, and then that just completely softens the area, and then in I go. It's hard. It's a lot of work. Yeah. Right. But I just find it works a lot better because in some patients, you're talking like eight pillows, right, to get a really good hip flexion to get that to relax. And how many of you are able to relax enough for your partner to get down in there? Yeah. Right. So this is where your deep breathing comes in, closing your eyes, trying to relax as much as possible. And then, of course, you get the odd patient that you get in there and all they do is laugh because it tickles. That was that you? Yeah. We'll do this and we'll take a break. So associated with this muscle, because they kind of come together, is a muscle called iliacus. It attaches from the upper two-thirds of the iliac fossa and the anterior inferior iliac spine and the sacral ala to the lesser trochanter of the femur. In other words, it fills in the entire medial surface of the ilium. Very broad, wide attachment site proximally. Okay? And it goes to the lesser trochanter of the femur. So they are separate muscles when they get down to their attachment. You can kind of see it here. They somewhat share the lesser trochanter together. And this is why we call it iliopsoas, because fundamentally, when you get into this area, you're really not separating one versus the other. It's kind of difficult, but they are separate muscles fascially when we look at them, but they do find attachment on the lesser trochanter. So it completely follows the same as psoas, anterior to the pelvic bone and posterior to the inguinal ligament as it passes through down to the lesser trochanter. And because it's the same configuration, what do you think about the actions? Right, pretty close. So this muscle crosses the hip joint anteriorly, which results in flexion of the thigh at the hip joint, and it crosses the hip anteriorly to wrap around the femur to attach to the lesser trochanter, which results in lateral rotation, which again is weak. The only thing it's missing is this muscle does not do lumbar flexion. Why? Because it doesn't attach to the lumbar vertebra. Okay? So psoas is the flexor of the spine when the pelvis is fixed, but iliacus is not, because it does not go to the lumbar vertebrae. All right? Reverse action, when the thigh is fixed, it pulls on the anterior surface of the pelvis, which can give it the anterior tilt. So iliopsoas, both muscles can cause anterior tilt and sway back, but iliacus does not do flexion of the lumbar vertebra because it doesn't have any effect on them. There's no attachment there. Okay? Innervation is femoral nerve L2, L3, or when we look here, this is lumbar plexus L1, L2. So psoas has a bit of a different innervation, 1, 2, and 3, whereas iliacus, we're talking femoral nerve L2, L3. Right? It's a branch off lumbar plexus. Muscle test is the same. You cannot differentiate between psoas and iliacus when you're doing muscle testing. You just can't. Same idea that we can see here. Okay? Same stretches, same strengthening, all that kind of stuff. Want to do one more while we're at it? How many slides are left here? Okay. We're not on three.
We are at eight.
Eight? Okay. Do you want to take a break now? Thought we were more than eight. What do you want to do? Because we're leaving a bit early. Do you want a break now? Okay, let's take a break. Let's begin. I can talk loud when I talk low, but I can't talk loud when I have to talk high. All right, our next muscle. Again, another favorite among massage therapists, TFL. I was waiting to have to, I thought maybe you were coming down here. I was going to try it. Tensor fascia latae. It runs from the superior iliac spine and the anterior iliac crest to the iliotibial band one third of the way down the thigh. So the one thing you'll always hear me say is, it drives me mad when people say, I'm stretching my IT band. No, you're not, because you can't stretch an IT band, because it's not muscle. But you can stretch tensor fascia latae, and it does go down onto the IT band, okay? So, because it crosses the hip joint anteriorly, it does help in flexion. Because it crosses the hip laterally, it also does abduction. It does wrap from anteriorly on the pelvis to posteriorly on the ITB. And when it pulls on the iliotibial band, you do get some medial rotation. So because it comes from here and goes back to here, you do get medial rotation with it, okay? When the femur is fixed, it does pull down on the anterior pelvis, which does cause some anterior tilt as well. Innervation is the superior gluteal nerve, L4, L5, and S1. The muscle test, you guys do it right. It's kind of like the Ubers test. How did you test it? Side lying. And internal rotation, correct. And that's actually a test as well to see if it's tight. So the test is exactly the same position as the muscle test. To see if it's tight, instead of pushing on it, just let it go. If it's tight, the leg will stay up. If it's normal, the heel will come down to the table in that position. But the most important thing is that extension and rotation is utmost for it in order to do it. Yes. Now, it's the same thing when you strengthen it. So a lot of therapists will say, you know, TFL, just do abduction. No. This and this. Then you do the abduction. Try it. Stand up. Just use the table as support. Just try normal abduction. Okay? And then take and extend it and internally rotate it and then do it and feel the difference. Feel the difference? Maybe some of you are weaker in it. Not back. AB. That's better. Not back. Out. There you go. Feel the difference? Yes. Okay. So you notice a very distinct difference. Right? So we can see it on here. Now, the other thing is almost no one, ever works at its proximal attachment as part of a low back pelvic relationship problem. Because if the IT band is tight, you're going to get anterior tilt. This muscle, you know, getting into that sort of ASIS area down to that, and then dropping into that fleshy area is where you find this TFL. And very rarely do therapists work here, and I don't know why. I don't know why. Who wants to be a guinea pig? Hold on. Yeah, you can strike the pose facing the glass. You're going to strike the pose facing the glass. On your side, lying on the table.
Oh.
Okay, come down this way so you can straighten your leg out a bit. There you go. Okay, so again, finding that ASIS, and you got that thick pocket in, and then coming right in here. Okay, so you can take an elbow out, right? Yeah, because this muscle gets used a lot. Do you feel that? That right there, so she's really tight there. So I like to just use elbows here in side lying. It works really, really well. Is it referring at all or just sore? Yeah. So again, someone comes and they're having global pelvic problems to low back, not only do I work glute, med, and min, and max, I will come into here and see if there's a problem in here. And of course, then check the tension of the IT band. Crazy, eh? And I'm pushing like that. Okay. So when I was in a school, we were crazy. I had three guys I studied with, or four guys. And the first semester we learned about the IT band, we would do this and see who would groan or move first. Just get in there as deep as we possibly could. So you can see how you've got problem here, right? Yeah, crazy. So this is going to be part of the problem. There's a reason why this is sore. So you get this loosened off, this is going to come down. Okay? All right, thanks. Okay. All right. So you can see the stretch here. And again, please remember, this is the appropriate stretch, but you're not stretching the IT band. You're stretching TFL. IT band is fascia. It can't stretch, right? You can put tension on it, and you can weep it a bit, but ultimately it's TFL. Notice the position, right? You need to see this one is almost a little bit incorrect because what position is he in here? He is somewhat extended, but he needs to internally rotate a bit more, right? Which you can see here. Okay, you can do it in side lying as well if you wish to. And there's one of the stretches that I like to do. She's got a larger ball there, but you know, I can use. I always start patients off with soft to firm. So there's now these fascial balls, and when I first started doing this, there was no such thing as a fascial ball. And then I'd go to a tennis ball, and if they were feeling good with a tennis ball, then the next step is a golf ball. Yeah. Now you can buy pain balls. I use a pain ball. They're little hard rubber balls. Now you can buy some have spikes on them, some don't. You've seen those. So those work really well as well. I don't like rollers for this. IT band a roller is good for, but not for TFL because it's too small muscle to get at. It's hard to kind of get into that area. So any of those will work really, really well. Trigger points. Refers deep into the hip joint and down the outside of the thigh. An active or latent TFL trigger point can also produce excessive tension in the muscle and iliotibial tract that contributes to a condition known as IT band syndrome. So what happens is you can see that the IT band does cross the knee here. I think we deal with that in knee coming up. I can't remember. It crossing here. And if TFL is tight, it creates too much tension on the IT band there, which you saw. And that then starts to affect where it crosses at the knee. IT band syndrome is basically a form of inflammation at this distal part here at the knee joint. And IT band syndrome is classic. You have no pain until you start working out, and then the pain just becomes excruciating. Really common with runners. And then the IT band is also a bursa behind it, and then it gets irritated as well. And then it really, especially runners, it really can affect them as far as that goes. So anytime you hear IT band syndrome, if the patient said, I have had IT band syndrome, then get right up here and start working. That's part of the problem. It could be due to their two valgus or varus as well, depending on their gait and so forth, but get to that TFL. Get to this TFL and work on it. Sartorius. Anterior superior iliac spine to something called the pezanserine. Have you heard this yet? Okay. Have you palpated the pezanserine? Okay. And what's the acronym? For the three muscles. Serve Grace T. Serve Grace tea. That's how I always remembered it. Say grace before tea. Okay. There's too many words there. Serve grace tea. Simple. Because you'd be in a test going, but comes before, right? Yeah. Serve grace tea. Okay. So down to that pezanserine. So you can see that it's coming here from the ASIS down to the medial aspect of the leg and then coming around onto this proximal tibia here at the pezanserine, okay? Its muscle crosses the hip joint anteriorly, which results in flexion of the leg. It also crosses the hip joint laterally, which is abduction. And because it crosses the hip joint medially, then that in a way has to wrap from anterior on the pelvis to posterior on the tibia, you get lateral rotation when at the knee joint, when the leg is fixed to the thigh. In other words, what shape does it create? Sorry? A four. No, a four, right? See number four there in my leg? Okay. It's the figure four. Hey, Michelle talked about that too? Yeah, so it's the figure four. I used to have another name for it. It was a particular profession, and it's tailor. Thank you, the tailor's position. Right. So, it also crosses the knee posteriorly, which is flexion of the leg at the knee joint. It crosses the knee joint medially from posterior to anterior to the pes anterine, which is medial rotation of the leg at the flexed knee. In other words, this muscle does a lot. There's a lot of movements, okay? In its reverse action, when the tibial attachment is fixed, it does pull the pelvis, causing the anterior pelvis to face to the opposite side of the body. Therefore, you get a little bit of contralateral rotation of the pelvis. Again, not major, though. And it crosses the knee joint posteriorly. If the distal attachment is fixed, it flexes the thigh at the knee joint. Okay, it can do this. All right? It is also thought to protect the femoral artery because it follows the same line as the femoral artery. So again, coming across here, we can see that sartorius muscles here, again, from the ASIS coming down across the front of the thigh around, and here we can see the pes anserine right here. Innervation, femoral nerve, L2 and L3. Obviously, the muscle test would be the opposite of that figure four position. In terms of testing it, we can see here is your pes anserine. From back to front, serve, sartorius, grace, gracilis, T, semitendinosus, because it has the T in it, right? Okay. Now note here, and it's something nobody talks about much, and I never thought about it. I don't know why, because I used to be a runner, and I started getting this terrible pain in my leg. One year I started putting some miles on, I had pes anseritis of the bursa. I had a bursitis of the pes anserine. So there was a bursa under here where the stream of the muscles come around, and it can get irritated with runners and that type of athlete. Okay, so just be aware of that, where it comes from. This is a Netter drawing. Did anybody ever end up buying the Netter book? Because I mentioned it. Has anybody seen the Netter book? It's seen it or you bought it? Yeah, they're amazing, aren't they? And they're all oil paints and watercolors. Yeah. So your stretch is here. Any of these will stretch. And then, of course, strengthening, we can see here a little bit with the surgical tubing. Kind of hard to strengthen it on its own. And really, you don't have to, per se. You've got a lot of other muscles that help along with it. Okay, so that was that group. Now we've got, that was the flexor group. Now we have the adductor group. So the first is called pectineus. The pectineal line on the pubic ramus to the proximal posterior shaft of the femur at the pectineal line. So we can see coming from this area here on the pubic bone, coming around in behind onto that pectineal line. Remember, the pectineal line was also called the spiral line. Correct, right? So it's back here. Okay? So it's coming a little bit from anterior on the pelvis to at the pubic bone down to this pectineal or spiral line on the femur. You can sort of see it here as well in terms of I have here. Why did I pick this picture? I don't know why I picked this picture. Oops, sorry. The group is of course here. I just don't know why I picked that picture. It's not that great a picture. Functions. It crosses the hip joint anteriorly, makes sense, right? From pubic bone back to the femur. So it crosses the hip joint anteriorly, which of course is flexion of the thigh at the hip joint, which is its primary action. It crosses the hip joint medially, which results in adduction of the thigh at the hip joint, but that's not its primary movement. It was flexion that was, okay? The muscle attaches to the posterior femur anterior to the mechanical axis of rotation, which results in medial rotation of the thigh at the hip joint. So we have to think of where the mechanical axis of rotation occurs. That would be the head of the femur within the acetabulum. You know, your axis, so you've got to think of anatomically that straight line from superior to inferior. And we're saying that it's It's anterior to that mechanical axis, so therefore it is a medial rotator, because it comes, the axis is back here, and this muscle is kind of here, right? So it's a little bit, it's in front of it, so therefore it's a medial rotator. Reverse action, when the femoral attachment is fixed, it pulls on the anterior pelvis, which is, again, an anterior tilt of the pelvis. So the reason I'm putting these in here is because if you do see an anterior tilt to the pelvis, it's just not psoas you need to think about. Psoas is the most likely cause, but there will be contributing muscles that support anterior tilt that you need to consider when you're trying to get that back to a proper position, okay? Innervation, femoral nerve, L2, L3. The stretch, you can notice the position of the foot that helps. That gets a better action. So if the foot were forward, you'd be getting more iliopsoas groupings. By doing this with the foot in this rotation, you will get the pectineus for it. And of course, any kind of ankle strap, those sorts of things will help work with it as well. So the true adductors, there are three: longus, brevis, and magnus. So we'll do longus first, which I tells you it is the longest. It arises from the anterior body of the pubis to the middle one-third at the medial lip of the linea aspera. Remember how the spiral line came around to linea aspera, right? And linea aspera splits into the two epicondylar lines, right? Supracondylar lines, sorry. Okay, so we're down into the linea aspera on the medial lip. It crosses the hip joint medially, which results in adduction, which is its major action. It also crosses the hip joint anteriorly, which is some flexion. But this muscle also, on the posterior femur anterior to the mechanical axis of rotation, which is lateral rotation. Yes. So it's a lateral rotator, whereas pectineus is a medial rotator. Okay? Because just where it sits in its attachments. Obturator nerve, L2, L3, and L4. And we can see here in the diagram, here's where pectineus is. Takes a relatively large group here. And we can see that adductor longus is just the other side of the body and the crest of the pubis. We can see the attachment here coming down. Now, the thing is, someone is a hockey player and they do an adductor strain. You've got to determine which one it is. And quite often, the tear can be down here, but sometimes the problem can be up here at the attachment as well, right? So this is why you need to be able to palpate that pubic bone. Now, obviously, in this area here, we'd have to be very careful or not at all, depending where the problem is. But certainly down here, we can, and we can up here at the pubic bone as well, in terms of affecting some change there, okay? So there's your classic stretch for it. And then strengthening, of course, would be resisted adduction, right? Trigger points. There are several zones of pain. There are two zones localized around the anterior hip and above the knee, and two anteromedial thigh from inguinal ligament to medial knee joint, and the third medial thigh from hip to knee. So it can cause a lot of sort of get the area here into the inguinal area here. On this picture, down to superior aspects of the knee here, you sort of see the same idea happening here in musculinos with some residual referral pain running down, not all the way to the foot, but to the ankle. Gracilis. This muscle attaches from the anterior body and inferior ramus of the pubis to the pesandrine. So this is the second muscle of the pesandrine. This is grace. Okay? So we can see here is, we had adductor longus here, and then of course we have pectineus here, and then right off that area, so we said anterior body, inferior ramus, this area right here, coming all the way down the thigh, medial thigh, to be the second muscle in the pesandrine. So we had sartorius anteriorly, and then we have gracilis, and then the posterior is semitendinosus, one of the hamstring muscles, okay? So we've got it coming down to here. It crosses the hip joint medially, of course, which results in adduction of the thigh at the hip joint, which is its prime movement. It crosses the hip joint anteriorly, so therefore it helps to flex the thigh at the hip joint. It also crosses the knee joint posteriorly, which also helps in flexion. So because it crosses both posteriorly and anteriorly in terms of as it travels through, it can do both. Crosses the knee joint medially from posterior to anterior at the pezandrine, which then allows for some medial rotation of the leg at the flexed knee joint. So you probably all learned, I don't know if you've done this in lab yet, but a fixed leg will not rotate at the knee, correct? But a flexed one will. Did I say that right? An extended knee will not rotate at the knee, but a flexed knee will rotate. It's not huge, it's just a little tiny bit. And that's what we're saying here, is that because it comes down onto that medial aspect of the tibia, in the flexed knee, it can cause some medial rotation. Innervation, obturator nerve, L2, L3, the muscle test is all those movements in opposite, of course. And we can see it here. Again, here is pectineus, here is adductor longus, and now we have gracilis running in here. So we've kind of gone a little bit anteriorly within the adductor compartment, and then to more medially with gracilis being that break down that medial border of the skin in the inside of the thigh, just underneath. And again, there's your pezandrine. Stretches and whatnot are pretty much exactly the same. As well as when you're, you know, when we look at these adductors, when you're doing resisted adduction, you're not really isolating one versus the other per se. You're just doing it as a group. Adductor brevis. So we had longus, which means long. Brevis means short. So this runs from the inferior ramus. So the previous muscles we've all been doing are arising from the body or the superior ramus. Brevis arises from the inferior ramus of the pubic bone. So hence the reason why it's shorter. So the inferior ramus of the pubis to the proximal one-third of the femur at the linea aspera. So all getting around to this linea aspera is just that this one arises from the inferior ramus of the superior. It crosses the hip joint medially, of course, which is adduction of the thigh at the hip joint, which is its prime. Crosses the hip joint anteriorly, which is flexion. If the thigh is flexed far enough in front of the body, it will now extend the leg. So, which kind of makes sense, right? If you think that it's coming here, if I'm back here, I've got it on stretch, and it's going to pull, it's going to flex from this point as well, right? So we're saying, if it's flexed far enough, sorry. I did the opposite. Sorry. If the leg is here, because it was the other way as well, if the leg is here, then because of where it is, it will bring the leg back to this point. Okay? When the knee is extended and fixed, this muscle pulls the leg into medial rotation at the hip joint. And it's sort of doing this. But this has to be fixed down here. Okay? Innervation, obturated nerve, L2 and L3. So we can see here is adductor brevis here. So in our grouping, we can see them all in here coming all together. And again, from the adductor brevis is coming from the lower. This isn't a very good picture because this should be a bit deeper because it's coming from the inferior ramus. Stretch is the same and the strength is the same as it was for the other in the group thus far. Trigger points in brevis, exactly the same generally as was for the others. Now, adductor magnus is the odd one out. It's obviously the largest. Well, what's interesting is it has two heads. The anterior head is considered to be the adductor, but the posterior head is considered to be a hamstring. Okay, so it has two heads, there's a hamstring portion or an adductor portion. So the anterior head is the adductor. Inferior pubic ramus and ramus of the ischium to the gluteal tuberosity, linea aspera, and medial supracondylar line of the femur. Okay, so that's running sort of straight down that medial aspect. Whereas the posterior head, the hamstring portion, runs from the ischial tuberosity to the adductor tubercle of the femur. So what we can see here is, here's our anterior head here. This is your true adductor part. And we can see here, running quite a bit deeper down, right? So we're saying it goes to the ischial tuberosity, to the adductor tubercle. And you guys have palpated the adductor tubercle yet? Okay, so that is the posterior head, or the hamstring portion of adductor magnus. There is a space in between the two. We'll talk about it in a moment. You'll see there's a bit of a frame in here. So anterior head is the adductor component, and the posterior head is the hamstring component. To jump all the way down, because we have the two heads that are so significantly different, we have dual innervation. The anterior head is the obturator nerve, and the posterior head is the sciatic nerve tibial branch. So the anterior head is obturator, posterior is sciatic nerve, L2, L3, and L4. So they do have different innervation between the two heads. Right, so it's something to remember as well. So it crosses the hip joint medially, of course, which results in adduction of the thigh at the hip joint. It also crosses the hip posteriorly, therefore it extends the leg at the hip joint. And when the knee joint is extended and fixed, the muscle does pull the leg into medial rotation of the hip joint. That third one I probably wouldn't ask questions on, but what is important to understand is that it has two heads, dual innervation, playing a little bit of different roles, okay? So we can see here the way the two come down, again, to the adductor tubercle down here on the medial epicondyle, we can see that we have a foramen that's created here, and this allows the popliteal artery to pass from anterior to posterior at the knee joint. It travels through this. It's called the adductor hiatus, okay? And then, of course, this is the anterior part here, the adductor portion of adductor magnus. This is the posterior part here, which is the hamstring portion. And between the two of them, there is a space of attachment here, which creates this adductor hiatus, which allows this popliteal artery to pass through. There's also a nerve that'll pass through as well. Okay? This is a good stretch for magnus. And then these lovely machines that everybody likes, right? You know what I don't like about them? What have you done to the angle of the muscle as soon as you sit down? You somewhat altered it here a bit, haven't you? Right? I much prefer, when you want to do adductor work, I much prefer the ankle strap with the cables in this position rather than sitting like this, because you can change the angle ever so slightly with them as far as that goes. You'll find you're much stronger in this position than you are in this position, right? They're kind of a lazy man's adductor strengthening. Trigger points. It's true, the pelvic cramping and aching associated with premenstrual syndrome is largely expressed by a trigger point in the adductor muscle. So maybe if some of you do have significant premenstrual cramping, maybe get in there and see if you've got a heavy-duty trigger point in adductor magnus. Exactly, right? Going to the doctor going, can we do something about that? Right? I have a daughter who, when she's PMSing with cramping, she sometimes has to cancel work and be in bed for 2 or 3 days because she's just ill to the point of almost with nausea and possible vomiting and all sorts of things. So I feel your pain if that represents any of you in here, because she lived with me for a long time. So. But yeah, isn't that interesting? Okay. And if you commonly experience pelvic and or vaginal pain after intercourse, this trigger point is to blame as well. So again, I had another daughter who had what's called vulvodynia, and during intercourse, she would have significant pain, and it can be a trigger point, right? These are little tidbits you keep in your pocket when patients come to you and say, I've got this problem. I've been to every specialist known to man, and I can't get it fixed. And you go, wow, I remember Brian had this really disturbing conversation in class, right? And maybe it's a trigger point, okay? This doesn't come out of no research. Janet Travell did a lot of work in creating these trigger point maps and seeing lots of patients with lots of troubles. And so take it with a little more than a grain of salt when thinking about these trigger points and what the association might be, okay? Pain may be described as generalized pelvic pain, which can include the pelvic bone, vagina, rectum, and sometimes the bladder. This pain may be described as shooting up the inside of the pelvis and exploding like a firecracker. Anybody ever get pain like that? Yeah. No, it's too large. There's too much fascia there. It's a good question because it's not the same as splenitis anterior and medius with brachial plexus and that kind of stuff. So it's large enough that it generally doesn't tend to affect it. But if there's damage there, like a car accident or a sporting event or something like that, you can get compartment syndrome in this area, and it can cut off that popliteal artery, which feeds the whole leg. So I have seen, it was a terrible, terrible thing. We were playing flag football in Aurelia, and one of the guys got hit with the head of another guy while they were trying to take the flag and caused an excessive bruise in the adductor group to the point that it caused compartment syndrome. It swelled so badly, he started losing his pulse in his foot and his leg. So they had to do a fascial release. You know what that is? They literally cut him from his groin to his knee and just split open the fascia and leave it. He's in the hospital and his muscles are swollen outside the body, right? Because the swelling has to go somewhere. That's the problem with compartment syndrome. You have swelling that's occurring, has nowhere to go, so it compresses arteries and nerves. So they literally have to cut the fascia and let all the muscle come out. Speak to Jen Lynch about a fascial release. I won't tell you where or why. I'll let her tell you. But she's had fascial releases done. And it's just you get that much swelling. They're just giving an opportunity for the muscle to go somewhere without causing problems, allowing it to get back down to normal, and then they stitch it all back in again. And he was in the hospital for like 10 days-ish, somewhere in it. Okay, gluteal group, gluteus maximus, rises from the posterior iliac crest, the posterolateral sacrum, the coccyx, and the sacrotuberous ligament, thoracolumbar fascia, and the fascia over gluteus medius. That's a huge attachment, isn't it? Right, covers it. Well, it's a pretty big muscle, okay? So it does come all the way around in its attachment, right? Coming around. And it goes to the IT band and the gluteal tuberosity of the femur. So we can see here, you've got it coming all the way around to its attachments here. You can see the sacrum, the coccyx, and so forth. Here it's been cut away for you so you can kind of get a sense of its whole area here, and then comes down onto this IT band, right, and part of the femur. So it's all together here. It crosses the hip joint posteriorly, which is extension, which is its biggest one, which, of course, is the exercise everybody does for glutes, right, is kickbacks, right, sort of thing, okay? It wraps around the posterior pelvis, attaches laterally on the IT band and femur, so therefore you get lateral rotator. So this is a lateral rotator of the thigh on the hip joint. This muscle is the largest extensor and or lateral rotator of the thigh, but only contracts when forceful extension or lateral rotation is required, such as running and jumping. So it requires extensive tension in order to be activated, shall we say, to work. So again, running and jumping, this is where we use glute max more so. Okay. Upper one-third crosses the hip joint from medial to lateral superior to the hip joint, resulting in abduction of the thigh at the hip joint. The lower two-thirds crosses the hip joint from medial to lateral inferior to the hip joint, which results in adduction of the thigh at the hip joint. So if we think here, upper third is an abductor, lower two-thirds is an adductor. And it makes sense if you think about it, right? Up here is going to pull this way, isn't it? Correct? You can see that? Upper fibers up here will abduct. Lower fibers here will go this direction, which will adduct. Right? Just see where the fibers are, and it kind of makes sense. Uppers, going to pull up. Lowers, going to pull down. All right? Upper, abduct. Lower, adduct. Because it does find attachment on the IT band, it also extends the leg at the knee joint via the IT band. reverse action, sorry. When the thigh is fixed, this muscle pulls down on the pelvis, resulting in posterior rotation, and this is what you need to get up from a stooped position. So glute max is working every time you get off the chair. So let's try this. Put your pencils down, roll back a bit on your chair, and sit properly. Have you done this in lap? No. Roll back. Get out from under your desk. Okay. Sit up as straight as you can. Do not lean forward and get up out of the chair. Don't lean forward. Yeah. Not bad. Okay, that's giving you an idea how weak your glutes are. You should be able to come straight out of the seat and just have your glutes bring you up. Without leaning forward, you lean forward. As soon as you lean forward, you're bringing in everything else. not happening. So, again, someone's got some low back glute problems. Instead of getting on the rack and doing squats, again, I'm not against squats, for someone who's initiating and strengthening glutes, sit down, stand up, sit down, stand up. That's your exercise, right? Slow to the chair, slow off the chair. You don't have to settle into the chair, just the glutes just touch the chair and come back up again. Okay, it's a very good exercise for getting those glutes strong. Innervation, inferior gluteal nerve, L5, S1, S2. The muscle testing is a little bit extensive. You haven't done this muscle yet, have you, in lab? Did you do the muscle test for it? Do you remember the test? Okay, get to know these tests, man. Because you're going to have to do one on the OP, correct? You're going to have to do a muscle test in your OP, right? Yeah, okay. Okay, we can see it here. Stretching it, of course, can be hip flexion. Bridging, is that what you call this, bridging, I think, right? I've never understood this exercise because I think my glutes are strong enough. I don't really work my glutes when I do this, but I could see if someone's got weak and they're starting out an exercise, this may help a little bit. Either that or I'm not doing it right, I'm not sure which. Okay, and of course, the kickbacks here work really, really well. I once went, got into one of these in class at the Y. I did a fitness class, and they were doing, I call it the fire hydrant exercises, you know, doing all this stuff. And I got into it, and the next day, I couldn't get out of bed. I was just like, oh, my God, I can't move. Trigger points. The medial trigger point refers pain and tenderness in a crescent-shaped pattern across the buttock. It tends to concentrate along the edge of the sacrum and gluteal fold. Okay, in this area here, but can extend down into the upper posterior thigh region as well, which we can see a little bit here. So that's this trigger point. The lower trigger points refer pain across the entire buttock region, which concentrates over the lower sacrum, ischial tuberosity, and lateral iliac crest regions. You get deep tenderness in the buttocks associated with activity of this trigger point, and the client may also complain of sharp stabbing pain while sitting. Now, the tailbone trigger point, getting sort of into that tailbone area, refers pain to the coccyx and anal region. Clients may complain of pressure on the coccyx while seated when the trigger point is active, because it does come around to attach onto the coccyx. So you get into that area, you can get coccygeal pain to some degree, somewhat in the anal region. You want to be done? Had enough? Okay, I just want to do one demonstration before you go. I'll turn it off. I need a volunteer.